Chapter 7. Hallowed Ground. Suppose, Subhuti, there were a man endowed with a body, a huge body, so that he had a personal existence like Sumeru, king of mountains. Would that, Subhuti, be a huge personal existence? Subhuti replied, "Yes, huge, O Lord, huge, O well-gone, would his personal existence be. And why so? Personal existence, as no existence has that been taught by the Tathagata. For not, O Lord, is that existence or non-existence. Therefore it is called personal existence." At first glance, the idea of a man with a body as huge as Mount Sumeru seems quite grotesque. But it is only a huge personal existence because it is a lone existence. The point would be lost if everyone were as big as Mount Sumeru, that is, towered 84,000 leagues, a league is generally computed to be about 3 miles, above sea level. Konza, perhaps following one of the Indian commentaries, states that this passage is meant to stress the all-pervading greatness of the Dharma body. But Konza offers no compelling reasons for accepting what he presents as an incontrovertible interpretation. Indeed, he concludes by rather shuffling off his responsibility as translator and commentator, saying, quote, "the whole passage loses its point in translation," unquote. This is really just a smokescreen, for the translation is no more obscure than the original. No play upon words is lost in it, for example. There may well be the implication that the whole universe is the Dharmakaya, but there does not seem to be any definite connection. What is clear is the general principle that whatever you identify yourself with, even if following some forms of Vedanta you regard the whole universe as yourself, that personal existence is still a no-existence. The Buddhist view is that this, whatever it is, does not belong to me. This is not myself. In at least one form of Vedanta, however, the approach is rather to expand the self as much as possible, to expand consciousness to the extent that you become one with everything in the universe. This is a perfectly legitimate procedure up to a point, the practice of the 4 Brahma Viharas, the abodes of the gods, involving the development of metta, sympathetic joy, compassion, and equanimity, provides a not dissimilar path involving an expansion of feeling, if not of being. But to regard all beings as yourself, all bodies as your body, and whatever you see as yourself, is not a Buddhist but an Upanishadic strain of thought. According to the Upanishads, within you identify your Atman with the Brahman, and without you identify the whole of the universe with your own body. It is against such cosmic pantheism that this passage in the sutra is perhaps directed. Even if your body is a cosmic body, as a personal existence it is still a no-existence. What the Vedanta does not realize is that this universal cosmic body is still essentially shunya. You do not solve the problem of self merely by expanding yourself. However extensive the thing with which you identify yourself, there is still a limit to it if you do not regard personal existence as no existence. According to the so-called logic that runs through the sutra, even an existence as huge as Mount Sumeru would be huge because it was a no existence. However, it is perhaps appropriate at this point to remind ourselves of Chandrakirti's warning. Quote, "It is better to have a belief in the self as high as Mount Sumeru than to have a false view of Trinitā. Because if you are sick, medicine can cure you. But when the medicine has become poison, then what hope do you have?" Unquote. He is saying, in effect, that it is better to follow Vedanta and believe in the absolute self than to think that you and everything you experience is illusion. We can have a great time as Buddhists knocking down the ultimate truths of other religions like ninepins, saying, "there's no God, there's no soul," and so on. But these things at least symbolize something above and beyond the material and the mental. We have to be careful that we never allow a reduction of Buddhism to a form of materialism or nihilism to gain currency through misunderstanding shunyata. We may even go so far as to say that the classical form of the Anatman doctrine, stated baldly and literally, is beside the point and quite unhelpful. We may read about it in books on Buddhism, but if we are practicing Buddhists, the issue simply does not arise in this abstract form. The Atman that is being denied by this doctrine is our present being conceived as something ultimate, beyond which there is no wider or higher possibility, or which we are never going to transcend. Anatman means that the empirical self is not ultimate. What the doctrine is getting at is that beyond our present mode of existence and experience, there are other dimensions of being which we can grow towards in a way that is inconceivable to our present state of individuality. In denying the soul, the Anatman doctrine is not denying something deeper. It is saying that we shut ourselves off from anything deeper by asserting, "No, this is me." So to deny the soul in its poetic sense, as an expression for the deeper emotional aspects of one's existence, would put Buddhism in a completely false light. If the concept of Anatman has to be handled with care, it does have the positive value that it clears the way for a much more radical and far-reaching development than does the concept of soul. Mystics get into notorious difficulties when they try to interpret their experience in terms of God and soul. One of the great difficulties which confronted the Indian Buddhists was how they could give some idea, at least to the rational mind, of some higher level of consciousness which one can actually experience in the future, which one can, in a sense, actually become, without the ego appropriating it and using it to designate itself. Vivekananda, when he came to the West, used to say, "You are not sinners, you are divine. You are God." Which, of course, was all very refreshing at the time, and is fair enough as a statement, if one understands it to mean that, if one breaks down one's present individuality, one will emerge into our dimension, which is God, but which is nonetheless oneself. But what tends to happen is that one takes it to mean that I am in some respects God. What is meant to be the substance of the self is taken as an attribute of it, and it is very difficult to avoid a mild inflation of the ego at this suggestion. So Buddhism does not encourage one to imagine, "I am the Absolute, I am Buddha," or "I am enlightened," except perhaps in very advanced tantric practices, when one identifies oneself with the deity at the centre of the mandala. Even then, this takes place only under very special circumstances and with all sorts of safeguards and supports, including the watchful eye of one's teacher. The Buddha was concerned to deny the Brahmanical Atman doctrine because the idea of an immortal, unchanging, autonomous self, implied by the connotation of Atman with autonomy, had to be rejected as a species of the extreme view of eternalism. But he was also concerned to guard against the opposite extreme, annihilationism. So when Vachagotcha, the wanderer, asked him, "What have you got to say about the existence of the self?" he remained silent. After his visitor had left in disgust, the Buddha explained to Ananda that if he had replied that the self does not exist, quote, "it would have added to the bewilderment of Vachagotcha, the wanderer, already bewildered. For he would have said, 'Formerly I had a self, but now I have one no more.'" Unquote. The fact is that we do have a self as the sum total of our activities, our thinking, our seeing, our feeling, our willing, and our imagining. This self may be called Swabhava, own being. The Anatman doctrine simply warns us not to abstract an entity apart from and somehow activating these processes. There is something else behind them. There is another dimension of consciousness. There is even enlightenment. But it is not to be designated as a self. So when we assert that the self is empty, we must be clear what we are talking about. On the one hand, our own being, as the sum total of our activities, is empty, in the sense of being subject to the law of conditionality. On the other hand, the self, as an abstract identity behind those processes, is empty in the sense of being illusory, of not existing at all. In actual experience, of course, one cannot be quite sure where one's illusory self ends and one's real empirical self begins. The law of Anatman could therefore be stated thus: the self is illusory to the extent to which it claims to be absolute. That is, it is illusory to the extent to which it makes absolute demands or has absolute expectations, to the extent to which it expects the whole universe to revolve around it. There's an element of this in everyone. Why should this happen to me? Why shouldn't I be happy? Which is what prompts the arising of neurotic craving and hatred. It is this self which has to be discarded as illusory. It is neither helpful, healthy, to attempt or healthy to attempt to destroy the empirical self. A better model for our practice is one that involves the refining of the empirical self, making it ever more positive, until it evaporates, as it were, in some higher dimension. Associated with the real empirical self is a healthy desire and even a healthy anger or energy, which is neither good nor bad, but just happens to be the raw, even crude, materials that we need to work on and transform into something beautiful. The empirical self is as necessary to the Buddhist as clay is to the potter. We are on altogether safer ground if we speak not in terms of the classical Anatman doctrine, but in terms of growth. We can even speak of something that grows and sort out the metaphysics of that something afterwards. At the appropriate time, we will appreciate that this development of consciousness involves transcending our present individuality and becoming part of something much larger. After all, we have the capacity to experience dimensions of consciousness in dreams or under the influence of drugs that are hardly suspected or even recognized by our everyday self. So it should not be too difficult, without thinking of these analogies as equivalent to spiritual experience, to accept that our present sense of personal identity is not ultimate and can be transcended. Moreover, Subhuti, that spot of earth where one has taken from this discourse on Dharma but one stanza of four lines taught or illuminated it, that spot of earth will be a veritable shrine for the whole world with its gods, men, and asuras. What then should we say of those who will bear in mind this discourse on Dharma in its entirety, who will recite, study, and illuminate it in full detail for others? Most wonderfully blessed, Subhuti, they will be. And on that spot of earth, Subhuti, either the teacher dwells, or a sage representing him. Chapter 11 rehearses the theme of Chapter 8, the incalculable merit deriving from the exposition of this sutra. Chapter 12 goes further and extols the virtue of the very earth on which the sutra is expounded. The word translated as shrine is kaicha, which literally means something heaped up. Perhaps it was originally no more than a little heap of stones to which some sort of sacredness was attached, but the word came to be applied to any object of veneration, including sacred buildings, relics, images, and trees. In India today, you can often see stones that have been set up at the foot of certain trees. There are altogether 5 species of tree considered especially sacred in the Hindu world, including the banyan tree, the bell tree, sacred to Shiva, and the peepal, or bow tree, known by arborists as Ficus religiosa, but called by Buddhists the Bodhi tree, because it was while sitting under such a tree that the Buddha gained enlightenment. These trees are often found on the outskirts of a village, sometimes 5 of them planted as a group with stones piled at their feet, and people come to anoint them and make offerings of flowers. There may also be some source of this sacredness, like a dryad or devata living in the tree, made explicit, but more often than not, there is just a vague, instinctive sense of power emanating from that particular tree. In the Pali scriptures, there are many kaityas mentioned, and the Buddha seems to have spent many pleasant hours there, here and there, amongst them. When discussing the stability of societies, the Buddha advised the Vajjayans to keep up the offerings at their ancient shrines. It is surely a symptom of general cultural decline when people cease to respect their own traditions and culture. As long as the birthplaces of great national figures, or the places where they lived and worked, or other places associated with significant contributions to the community, like war memorials, are maintained at the national expense as a focus for our appreciation of great deeds and works, so long there remains at least some vestige of cultural vitality in the national community. Whether or not something of these great figures literally rubs off onto their immediate surroundings, whether there is some objective virtue or power that pertains to a particular sacred spot, or whether the atmosphere of a place is just a matter of association, is not easy to establish. In creating a sacred spot, you would probably choose a place that was already auspicious anyway, which is why churches were often built on the sites of old temples. There is no doubt, however, that places can develop an atmosphere of their own, certainly as a result of meditation or devotional practices taking place in them, and objects can be affected in the same way. When I was living in Highgate, I had 2 rupas which I had brought from India, one of Shakyamuni and the other of the 4-armed Avalokiteshvara. They sat on a big, heavy bookcase at the back of the room, and when I was working, I definitely felt that there were 2 people sitting there behind me. I was not worshipping the images myself all that much, but perhaps they had been the objects of much veneration in the past. I had another, more extraordinary confrontation with a rupa in the early 60s when I visited a friend in Bombay. This was an elderly lady who had become a Buddhist and had picked up a number of Buddhist images, one of them being a little Buddha image made of semi-translucent greenstone. As soon as I arrived, my friend sat me on a low armchair facing a window which looked out over the Arabian Sea, with this green rupa on the windowsill, and asked me to tell her what I could see. She was obviously quite excited. So I sat and looked for a while, and in the end I saw around the image a sort of green aura. It was not a circular halo. The figure was edged with a band of green light, which gradually expanded, filling the entire room with bright green light. Of course, I kept looking round for some straightforward source, a reflection from the sky or the sea perhaps, but the light was definitely coming from the image, and there was nothing delicate or subtle about it. It was almost crude, a bit like powerful fluorescent lighting. After a while, it just faded. Apparently, my friend's Christian servants had been quite frightened by the whole phenomenon. But according to popular Indian, though not Buddhist, belief, the image would simply be regarded as being particularly lively, or jagrat, awake. Indeed, Vajrayana Buddhists, as well as Orthodox Hindus, conduct life-establishing ceremonies over images, sometimes coinciding with the painting in of the eyes, which supposedly brings them to life. I suppose it is understandable that an object upon which many people's thoughts have been focused should become, in some sense, alive. This would seem to have been what happened to the relics of Shariputra and Moggallana when they were being displayed to several thousand people once in Burma. My old friend Bhikkhu Sangharatana said that he and everyone else present saw the relics actually circling round inside their little hermetically sealed glass capsules, surrounded by rainbows. He himself did not regard this as anything supernatural, attributing it to the force of so many people's thoughts. To be frank, when I was involved with organising receptions during their tour of India, I found the whole atmosphere surrounding these relics more fetishistic and commercial than strictly spiritual, even though they created some useful publicity for Buddhism on the popular level. All this goes to show that any sort of concentrated mental activity can apparently produce unusual physical effects. There is no reason, therefore, why it should not have an effect on the physical surroundings, the spot of earth where that activity takes place. We have been considering fairly short-lived effects, but what about a transcendental effect? The Diamond Sutra would seem to suggest here that the transcendental can produce effects via the human body, presumably, that would be perceptually different from, let us say, the powerful mundane effect of someone in the dhyanas. It is also fair to say that the whole thing is an exercise in skillful means. Hallowed places become focal points of national piety. Witness the pilgrimages to Canterbury in the Middle Ages, or the pilgrimages made to cultural monuments like Shakespeare's birthplace today. The Buddha is perhaps just trying to enlist some of this kind of piety and popular devotion in a refined and sublimated form to the cause of the Dharma. In claiming such power for the perfection of wisdom as to make holy any place where even a few lines of it have been expounded, he is stressing its significance and value. So perhaps this passage is simply what is called prasamsa, a sort of hyperbolical praise which is not to be taken too literally. After all, from a purely spiritual point of view, all places are equally sacred. The sacred cannot really be delimited in this way. It is probably not very healthy if we start to conform to norms of good behaviour within the confines of some consecrated place, as Christians do in a church and some Buddhists do in a shrine room, simply in order to be able to let ourselves go when we get outside again. Still, we are, most of us, drawn to visit the Buddhist holy places in India, and it is perhaps not just because some of the places where the Buddha lived and taught are much the same as they were in the Buddha's day. It is not just a question of getting nearer to the Buddha as an historical personality. These places are, for us, hallowed ground.